The synchronous meteorological satellite program at Goddard is being developed for the Environmental Sciences and Services Administration, sometimes erroneously known as the Weather Bureau. This satellite will be a new generation satellite for ESA. You're probably familiar with the TOSS, TYROS series, the Nimbus, and the low orbiting satellites. The SMS satellite will provide full-time coverage of the United States for both cloud cover and data collection services, which will be used by the ESA to distribute weather information throughout the United States and other countries. The SMS program at Goddard is a prototype operational program. Now, what I mean by that is that we are not really doing research and development on this program. We are prototyping an operational series for ESA. If the prototype system works out well, the ESA will procure follow-on spacecraft and modify additional ground stations to use this system. The Goddard Space Flight Center, the SMS project, is not building ground stations for the SMS program. The program consists right now of two prototype satellites, also supplying some equipment to the ESA ground stations, the primary ground station being at Wallops Island, Virginia. This station will receive the data from the spacecraft, retransmit the data to other stations, and also by landline to Suitland, Maryland, which is the major station for the ESA services. The SMS program, then, is again much like the ERTS program. It is being developed for a user. It is not an extensive research and development program. We are trying to use all of the existing technology that we can for the SMS program. The use of telescopes or cameras at synchronous geostationary altitude was started in 1966 on the ATS program. A lot of this effort was founded by Dr. Vern Summey of the University of Wisconsin. There was much information learned from this first geostationary telescope. There was new information on the wind patterns across the equator. We flew a multicolor camera at geostationary altitude on the ATS program in 67. That also produced additional data. We have found, however, though, that the black and white camera can provide all the data necessary for weather prediction. The color camera is just purely for sales force, you might say. On the SMS program, we will go into the IR range with the first series of satellites. Hopefully, we will be able to do sounding with follow-on spacecraft with minor modifications. The program is in its initial stage at Goddard. We finished the Phase B report in January. We had an RFP on the street in February, and the presentation was made to the administrator of NASA. Philco Ford was selected to be given a contract for the SMS spacecraft. The first slide shows an artist's conception of the Philco Ford proposed satellite. In the aft section of the spacecraft, there are S-band and UHF antennas. The S-band antennas will be used to bring the telescope data down to the Wallops station. The UHF antennas will be used for an uplink from data collection platforms. I'll go into more detail later on the telescope and the data collection platforms. The outside of the spacecraft, see the solar cell area. This spacecraft does spin at 100 RPM. It is spin stabilized in geostationary orbit. The opening you see, which is in artist's conception facing towards the Earth here, is an opening which goes into a 45-degree mirror in the spacecraft and into a 16-inch Ritchie Creation optics telescope. The same telescope is used for the visible and the IR data. This is a little summary slide of the main missions of the SMS program, the camera data, the retransmission of this data, the data collection, data relay, and we will have three environmental monitors onboard the spacecraft, a energetics particle measurements device, a magnetometer, and a solar X-ray device depicted in this space environment monitoring. These devices will be used for astronaut flight. A energetic particles device was flown on ATS-1, it has been flown on other spacecraft also, but for each Apollo mission, we have turned that instrument on. Houston has said that the information has been very helpful in monitoring solar activity and protecting the astronauts in case of solar flares when they're having extravehicular activity. The writing on this slide may not be visible towards the back of the room. The thing I did want to show by this slide is that there are 8 detectors in the visible range at 1/2 mile resolution each, which are directly in line with the 4-mile IR detector. This would be one scan of the spacecraft. Since the spacecraft is spinning at 100 RPM, and it takes approximately 1,800 lines to take a picture, it'll take about 18 minutes for each full picture to be taken by the telescope and transmitted to the ground real time. Data, when it is transmitted to the ground, is stretched, serialized, and retransmitted back through the spacecraft so that it can be acquired by smaller ground stations in places such as Boulder, Colorado, and Miami. The data coming down comes down in 30 millisecond bursts, which is the view time you have in one spin period of the satellite over the Earth. The data rate is about 27 megabits, so you can see that puts quite a restraint on ground stations, the bandwidth being about 25 megacycles and requiring about a 40-foot antenna with our 20-watt transmitter on board the spacecraft. So the stretching and serializing of the data is a necessity to get into smaller stations. We hope to be able to get into 15 to 18-foot dishes at about 3 to 4 megacycles bandwidth. This slide is just a little schematic showing the data being relayed to other stations. The VISR is an abbreviation for Visible Infrared Spin Scan Radiometer. This telescope is being developed by Hughes Santa Barbara. The same corporation did develop the 2 telescopes on ATS-1 and ATS-3. Also, Hughes Santa Barbara, under contract to Hughes El Segundo, is building the optics for the multispectral scanner on the ERTS program. The collection of data is a very prime factor of the SMS mission. This data to be collected from approximately a maximum of 10,000 sensors located throughout the United States in the near proximity of same will be used for many, many different purposes. As you can see over on the left, we have tsunami stations. This is your earthquake warning. Stations have those on land and also near the shore in different places. We hope to have right now that data is transmitted into Washington probably by landline, or if it's not important, it's just mailed in. We hope to have this real time. These stations will be engineered such that in case of an event occurring, they will trigger on automatically, play through the spacecraft, and be recognized at the Suitland Center in Washington. The data will be received while it's transmitted real time to Suitland. Going across the board, you see the merchant vessels, which will be relaying information through the spacecraft. Also the hydrological stations, which will give you the river currents, river heights, wind, temperature, data of this nature. Hopefully in the future, for a system of this type, it can be fully automated so that this data can be brought in synoptically, and in the cases of tsunami warnings, hurricanes, information like that can be brought in an emergency case, and the Environmental Sciences and Services Administration will be able to receive out of a computer essentially a weather map and weather prediction on an automatic and time schedule basis. Another function for the SMS is to retransmit WeFax data. This is weather facsimile data. We have been handling WeFax transmissions on the ATS-1 and 3 spacecraft for the Environmental Sciences and Service Administration about 12 hours a day on each spacecraft. This data is used by the DOD, is used by other locations of ESA, the Coast Guard, and small individual users throughout the United States and other countries. This WeFox data can be pictures taken from the TOS-TYROS series of spacecraft, or it can be any other type of data that is felt necessary to retransmit through the spacecraft. Present plans are that the uplink and downlink for the retransmission of WeFox will be in the S-band region. However, the satellite probably will have capability for UHF transmission if a user so requests. The prime purpose of a synchronous geostationary spacecraft is to have real-time and full-time coverage of the land underneath it, and to have full-time station acquisition of the spacecraft. As you can see by this slide, the lifetime of tornadoes is in the order of minutes, stretching on out through your cyclonic storms in the 1,000-hour region. If we look into the emergency weather conditions, the thunderstorms, the hurricanes, and the tornadoes, and we look into the low-orbiting spacecraft, we find, especially in the case of tornadoes, if the spacecraft is not over the tornado at that time, it's lost. We have learned with the ATS program that we can detect tornado fronts. We hope with the increased resolution with the SMS telescope that we will be able to do a better job and to have real-time forecasting and monitoring of tornadoes. Now, I'm not saying here that we're going to forecast a tornado over a specific town in a specific location. They come up too fast for that. But we can hopefully forecast tornado fronts in real time, and information can be transmitted to the appropriate authorities and the people in those areas warned. For the hurricanes, the ATS series of spacecraft have been tracking hurricanes with the telescopes on board for a number of years now. Hopefully we will be able to do a better job with the increased resolution on this spacecraft and provide the ESA a means of averting some of the disasters that have happened in the past. Now, the cost of this program is definitely in the low orders in millions of dollars, but we have been subjected to some figures where such weather phenomena as tornadoes cause approximately $200 million of damage and take about 20 lives a year in the United States. You all are familiar, probably more familiar, with the hurricane damage, flood damages, things of this nature. We do believe that this program will be beneficial to the taxpayer in the United States. The ships at sea have used data transmitted through ATS. We have monitored ice breakage, things of this nature, and again, this is in a real-time mode. To cover the Earth with an SMS-type spacecraft is impossible. We do lose the polar regions by being over the equator, and the look angle of the telescope, of course, does not pick up the edge of the ball. However, four synchronous meteorological spacecraft, equally spaced around the world, would cover approximately 85% of the globe real time. Now, we are not proposing to place four of these spacecraft in orbit. We will place two prototype spacecraft in orbit, which will hopefully be placed, if they are successful, one over the near edge of the United States in the Atlantic and one over the Pacific. The exact locations of these spacecraft being at the desire of the ESA. The follow-on spacecraft will be replacement spacecraft for these two spacecraft and will also have some improvements in technology on board for weather forecasting and data transmission. Where are the other two spacecraft coming from? Where are we going to complete this net? Well, we have been dealing some with the Italian and some with the French. We do feel now that the French will be putting up a program which they call Mediasat. It will have approximately the same characteristics as the SMS program. The resolution of the telescope may be a little less than ours. The data collection system hopefully will be near the same frequency. Also, the Italians are working with a communications satellite now. In the future, they may choose to put up a system of this type. The Japanese are also interested in a data collection satellite. So this has caused necessity for a number of meetings in the past to try and coordinate the activities so that we do come up with a program to aid the World Weather Watch and to aid data collection from ships at sea and items of this nature. A lot of questions have been asked in the past by engineers, and I'm sure that probably some of you out there would like to have this answered. Well, if ERTS has a telescope on board, SMS has a telescope on board, you can see the reason for the two different missions, the different altitudes, and the data going to different users. But what about the data collection systems? Why are we flying two different data collection systems on two different satellites out of Goddard, two different programs? We have studied this extensively. The ERTS program does require, as was presented by the previous speaker, a blithering type system, in other words, a random transmission platform to the spacecraft, since it has no interrogation through the spacecraft to turn the platform on. It would complicate the system immensely to interrogate the ERTS platforms. The SMS has a requirement for 10,000 platforms versus 1,000 for ERTS. The only way that we can handle 10,000 with the bandwidths that we have is to have a regimented type system. This means a fairly stable oscillator, which in the case of a time platform would turn it on once every 6 hours, the oscillator being in the order of 10 to the 5th to 10 to the 6th. For an interrogated platform, we would have to have clear channels through the bird. We would not be allowed a sloppy oscillator in the time systems to overlap into these channels. The users of the data collection system on the SMS spacecraft will go beyond the ESA. The ESA, of course, will coordinate all activities in this nature, but they have contacted the DOD, the Coast Guard, and other agencies to see how many channels that they would like to have on the SMS data collection system. The data rate that we have from each of the platforms is lower than the ERTS system. We're talking about 100 bits per second, in the neighborhood of 100 to 150 bits per second from the platforms through the spacecraft. You must realize here that these platforms are, again, the same as in the case of ERTS, supposed to be inexpensive, and they may be placed remotely and run off of batteries. So we have a cross-pollinated problem here of low power requirements, because they will be off of batteries. We don't want to be running out in the field changing batteries all the time. Low bit rates to keep the antenna size and the transmitter power down. And in the case of the receiver, a good stable receiver, because we'll also have a small antenna. We have not chosen to procure the data collection platforms with the prime contract. Procurement of the data collection platforms at the present time will be the responsibility of the Environmental Sciences and Services Administration, with possibly some R&D work being done by the project.
A member of the audience asks about the electronically despun antennas.
We'll have approximately 18 degree beam width on the electronically despun antennas. In the RFP, we ask for electronically despun antennas or mechanically despun if reliability could be so proven. I'm sure that today the mechanical despun antennas can do the job. We do have a 16-inch rocking mirror on board the spacecraft. We are looking for in the order of 0.025 milliradians accuracy on that mirror. So any rotating device or any counter-rotating device on the spacecraft could be detrimental to its stability. That was one of the reasons. Another reason with the solid-state amplifiers that you have now at S-band and the size of the spacecraft being about a 5-foot diameter spacecraft did make it quite optimum for an S-band electronically despun antenna rather than mechanical.
What is the present schedule for this project?
The present schedule for the SMS program, we hope to have a contract signed with Philco Ford either in December of this year or early in 1971. If that schedule is held, we hope to launch in the summer of 1972, the first spacecraft. a multifunctional satellite for the late 70s. Dr. Sajjad Durrani was born in Pakistan, received his bachelor's degree in mathematics and electrical engineering there. He received his master's in electrical engineering in Manchester, England, and a doctorate at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Dr. Durrani has taught for a number of years. He's worked with General Electric and RCA. Since 1968, he's been with the Communications Satellite Corporation, COMSAT. He is currently the manager of the Advanced Systems Branch in the Systems Analysis Lab.
The subject of this paper is a multifunctional satellite for the late 1970s. I'd like to briefly mention where we are now and how we got here. The present commercial communications satellite system is owned by an organization called Intelsat, which has members from something like 70 countries. In other words, all the satellites are owned by this consortium. COMSAT acts as the manager for this organization and is also owning partly the Earth stations within the United States. All the other Earth stations abroad are owned by various administrations there. The slide shows the series of satellites that were built during the last few years, starting with Early Bird in 65, and presently we are waiting for Intelsat 4, which will be launched early next year. As you can see from the slide, the weight and the number of circuits carried by these satellites have successively grown over the years. Intelsat 4 will be able to provide something from 3,000 to 10,000 voice circuits per satellite. The variation depending on how many circuits are carried by the narrow spot beam and how many by the wide global beam. The present service is available on a global scale. There are 6 satellites in orbit at this time, 4 of which are Intelsat 3s, one on each ocean, the Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Ocean, and a second one also over the
Atlantic Ocean.
2 Intelsat 2s to make the complete global system. The present satellites perform the services mentioned at the bottom of the slide. The trends at this time are towards the expansion of conventional services and also the provision of new services, of reducing the Earth station sizes and increasing the satellite complexity. Future systems will involve digital techniques. Considerable study has been done on these. Last year in November, there was a conference, international conference held in England by the British IEEE and the Intelsat organization. The proceedings of that are available through the British IEEE and discuss the state of art in this subject. New modulation and multiple access techniques were also covered by this conference and also by the AIAA conference held earlier this year. I'm referring to these for those who want to pursue this further. There are several new services in addition to the conventional traffic that I will touch upon briefly in today's paper. TV distribution, domestic communications, aeronautical, maritime, small user, and space vehicle communication services. Now, many of these have been studied before, and excellent detailed reports are available. The main point of putting them in today's paper is that we are looking at a system, say, 7 or 8 years from now, where the satellite size might be larger, and it might be able to accommodate more than 1 or 2 services in it, as contrasted to the previous studies, which were having a dedicated system for each service, a small satellite like 300 to 500 pounds for, say, the aeronautical service, or a small satellite for TV distribution and so forth. Instead of individually providing those, we are now examining what the impact would be of doing all that with one satellite. The advantages and disadvantages of doing this are listed on the slide. The most important one, obviously, is that you might be able to share the costs with other users. And the most important disadvantage follows from the same approach, namely, if you have several users, they might have conflicting requirements, and you might have to compromise on some of those. I'll now take up the six services that I listed earlier individually, very briefly describe the concepts. I won't go into the detailed link calculations or detailed system parameters in the talk, although the results of those are available in the paper. In the expanded conventional traffic, we expect the number of voice circuits to increase. We can look at several new ways of meeting this expanded demand. SPADE and MAT are the acronyms for two new approaches that have been considered by Intelsat. SPADE is a single channel per carrier system, because it's not strictly frequency division multiplex, although you assign different frequency channels for each carrier. You don't multiplex them before you put them on. Perhaps I shouldn't have written it that way on the slide. But FDMA stands for frequency division multiple access. So each of the carriers obtains access to the satellite because of its operation at a different frequency. The MAT system is a digital system entirely. You convert all the voice signals into digital signals. You do that in SPADE as well, but you keep each channel separate, whereas in MAT you'll have them all put together through a buffer. The estimated way of accommodating the new traffic shows that you could do it with 3 transponders at K-band and 6 transponders at C-band for the expected traffic at that time. Shown in this slide, a comparison of how these new techniques will enable a large number of channels to be accommodated in each transponder. The Intelsat 4 has 12 transponders on board. Each one of them is 36 megahertz wide, and each transponder, with the present arrangement, the lowest curve shows how many channels it can provide. Each of the transponders can have 900 channels if there is only one station having access to the satellite, but if you increase the number of stations, then the number of channels per transponder falls very rapidly with the existing modulation and multiple access arrangement. With the new arrangements, you can get the capacities much higher, as shown there. The almost horizontal curve at the level of 794 channels per transponder is for the SPADE system. And SPADE, incidentally, has been approved for operation by Intelsat with Intelsat 4 satellites, so some Earth stations will have modified equipment available. The top curve is the digital MAT system, which is nowadays being tested extensively. Recently, they've completed tests in Japan and Australia, and they've been running them at about 50 to 60 megabit per second rates. They're expecting to go up to about 200 megabit per second rate, and with that, they can accommodate larger number of channels. For this one service, I do have a couple of link parameters or design parameters, but we won't be doing this for the remaining services. Just as a typical example, the expanded traffic can be accommodated at 2 bands, either C or K. C band is the present operating band, and K we expect to be allocated for this purpose after the 1971 Space Conference. The parameters are listed here. In conjunction with the standard Earth station, which is the first column, we have a G over T, a gain over temperature ratio of 40.7. But when you have somewhat smaller Earth stations with 30-foot diameter instead of the present 97-foot diameter, you would have a smaller G over T. We would have to operate with rather narrow beams at K-band, and mostly they will be used for high-density traffic links, say between Europe and U.S. Weights and sizes and so forth for all these services, as I said, are available in the paper and various other studies. They'll be collected in one or two tables at the end. Right now, I simply want to give you an overall view of what other services we want to accommodate in there. The TV distribution has been proposed quite often. I perhaps should mention in a word or two the distinction between the present TV via satellite and TV distribution. Primarily it is on the size of the Earth station and the way you are originating and distributing the program. With TV distribution, you would use something like 30-foot Earth stations, which will receive the program from satellite and then redistribute them locally. Whereas at present, you get it from abroad via satellite, but it's fed into the Earth station at Eaton, West Virginia, and then goes to the TV studios in New York and gets across the country on the AT&T microwave network. There are other TV programs that have been discussed, namely community distribution, or community broadcast, I should say, which will not use 30-foot Earth stations, but maybe 5 to 10-foot Earth stations. They might be used for educational purposes. And then there are the direct-to-home programs, where you might have only a rooftop antenna, but they will be much further away because they require much bigger satellites. We've discussed only the TV distribution here. You can get CCIR quality TV signals by having 37 dBW. If it were 40 dBW, it would be 10 kilowatts. So it's something of that order. The domestic communications service has been discussed in response to the FCC inquiry on this subject. And to be quite impartial in the choice of the system design to be described, I did not choose the CompSat proposal there, but chose one from GE, which was quite detailed and has created quite a lot of favorable comments from many sources. In this rather ambitious arrangement, they visualized local telephone exchange, teletype exchange, and what they called a telemail exchange. A telemail service is a new service which would allow small businesses to go via this end office to the satellite and then back down through a similar end office to another business office. So it would allow the transactions that business correspondents normally contain to be conducted via satellite, and their cost estimates show that you can do it almost at the same expense as you do for airmail delivery. So you might have a letter by 10 cents via satellite. The other facilities are public messages, private wires, computer networking, and there is a long list of similar services that can be provided via something like 30-foot diameter antenna earth stations. All this can be done by about, say, 200 end offices in the U.S. and only one routing center which monitors the operation of the system and allocates various channels for operation. They estimated about 3 million subscribers for telemail could be accommodated in one transponder which has 20 megahertz bandwidth, something like 20 watts power. But that will be again at the end. I'll be listing these together. In telemail, virtually they are visualizing a teletype channel with 300 words per minute, and the other services would require somewhat wider bandwidth. Slide showing the basic arrangement for an aeronautical or maritime service. Allocations for these services exist in the VHF band and L band, the L band being around 1500 and 1600 megahertz. The aeronautical satellite proposal has been around for quite a few years. CompSat has made several proposals. We might even have such a system in existence even before the time frame that we are talking about, but the lifetime of the systems is expected to be 3 to 5 years, and by the time the late 70s or early 80s, we might even be able to incorporate the aeronautical service along with other services in a multifunctional satellite when we replace the earlier versions. I've not gone into any details of the transponder or the power requirements. I've shown simply how you might be able to provide sufficient coverage over the regions that are of greatest interest on the aeronautical routes. This service can at the same time meet the needs of maritime communications by allowing ships and boats and fishing fleets and so forth to get messages back to the shore station. The fifth service is the small user service. You might have these data collection type of users. You also can have isolated villages, exploratory teams, unattended machines and sensors, and so forth. We've got two categories of small users, one being a standard user with an antenna of about 6 foot diameter and a larger data rate. The other is a mini user with almost an omnidirectional antenna and a 300 bits per second requirement. This small, very small user, the mini user, might be the one that's a river gauge or some remote drilling operation where you don't require too much information continuously. The way this system would be arranged is shown in this slide. Basically, it just shows a lot of small users, which are standard or mini. They operate in conjunction with a rather large station, which is connected to the local users, also to the central office from where you might send information back, say to the Suitland Center, if I may say so, and similar other users, the head offices of those users. The last service that we examined here is the Space Vehicle Communication Service. There are several types of space vehicles with varying requirements of data transmission. I've listed a few of these. We did a recent study along with IBM for McDonnell Douglas contract on the space station program, and the last entry is for that, where you have a rather strict requirement of two color TV channels along with high speed data and voice. The capability of Intelsat 4 would be very limited to provide any of these services because it has only, each transponder has only 6.3 watts of RF power, and it either has a global antenna or it has a narrow beam spot antenna, as I mentioned earlier. Even the spot antenna has about 4.5 degrees beam width. For these, you would require very much narrower beams and larger antennas and larger power. The best way to operate on this would be at K-band between the space station and the relay satellite. From the relay satellite down to Earth, you could operate on C-band or any of the other bands, including K. In most of these studies, the question of frequency allocations is really critical, and in particular, that's the case for the space station program, because many of the available frequencies where you have to share the band with other services have to be operated under very strict constraints. There are two types of constraints that we have tried to show on this slide. They result in the significant interference entries labeled A, B, C, and D. The first entry is A, which is caused at the receiver in the space vehicle because it might be illuminated by the main beam of a terrestrial microwave radio relay link. These links are permitted to radiate up to 47 dBW towards the synchronous orbit and even more, namely 55 dBW in other directions. Now, if the space vehicle happens to pass through this main beam, it will certainly have a lot of this interference coming in, and you would naturally tend to overcome that by providing some higher radiation from the relay satellite. However, that runs into this problem labeled interference B. If the relay satellite is really very powerful, then it will be illuminating the Earth with a very high flux density, and there are restrictions by the CCIR on the extent of flux density that you can tolerate on the Earth's surface. Now, C and D are similar interferences at the other frequency, one being for the uplink, the other being for the downlink. At K-band, we hope that the interference problem would be much less. For one thing, there aren't that many users. For another, you might be able to get clear frequency allocations. As I said earlier, the results are collected in the last two slides, almost the last two slides. The services are listed along with the bandwidth requirements and the number of antennas required for each one. Now, this was a very preliminary study. You could easily eliminate some of the antennas by combining the operation with some other service and utilize the same antenna. As it is, it looks like a rather large number of antennas, an antenna farm up there almost. So we've got those studies still to be done, like what's the best way of combining these services and reducing the number of antennas and the other requirements. The next slide shows the same kind of thing for the power and the weight required for each service. And to remind you of what these services were, the remarks column says they are equivalent wide channels for conventional service down to high data rate links for the Earth Resources satellite or one TV channel for the space station program. All these things can be accommodated in the weights that are listed on the slide. The point I'd like to mention is that in many other studies, you have to provide a complete self-contained satellite for each service, whereas here, by using a multifunctional approach, you are, of course, utilizing some common subsystems, and you are not penalized to that extent. These are very preliminary estimates of the weights required, not just for the communication system, but communications plus the other parts of the structure, the station keeping, the attitude control, the thermal control, and the other subsystems. They are all lumped in together and prorated for each of the services. We come to this interesting conclusion that if we can have something like 2,500 pounds, a satellite, useful payload, we could accommodate these six services. If you don't have that large a satellite, you could, of course, still optimize it by having three or four of these services instead of all. As a comparison with Intelsat 4, we've got here the weight budget for the communications subsystem, for the power system, and the structure, fuel, and so forth. With 2,500 pounds useful payload weight, you might need something like 2,600 at liftoff. Now, the Titan IIIC with direct injection can have something of the order of 2,100 pounds in synchronous equatorial orbit and 2,800 pounds in inclined orbit. And the recent study by JPL indicated that some improvements could easily increase the weights by about 300 to 400 pounds. So it's within the state of the art to have this kind of payloads under consideration. The power requirement was not very unreasonable either. Something like 2 kilowatts is expected within the next few years. In conclusion, trends do indicate that new services will be required. We have several advantages of providing them through a multifunctional satellite of the parameters indicated. And the problems that need still further study are essentially the frequency plan, which has considerable problems with it, the optimization of the system by combining or varying the requirements, the mechanical configuration of the satellite, and the coordination between prospective users. By that we mean if you have conflicting requirements for about where the satellite should be best located and how much weight or power should be really allocated for each particular service, we still have to figure those out by finding out how much each prospective user can contribute to the program in funding it and then trying to accommodate the whole program to the requirements.
A question from the audience as to the cost of this system.
The costs are always a difficult question. When we had a recent exercise at our headquarters for costing out something in response to an FCC inquiry, and there are all kinds of different figures coming up, because do you include R&D, do you include the prototype in the R&D, or do you exclude it, and so forth. But there are two programs that Intelsat is currently looking at. One is an experimental satellite program, and one is an advanced technology satellite program that might come after the experimental if the first one is successful and so forth. The total R&D costs they expect to be something of the order of $50 million. After that, we don't know how much the satellite itself would cost. Now, Intelsat 4, which is about 1,250 pounds weight and has something like 500 watts of DC power on board, each Intelsat 4 will cost something of the order of $12 million after taking away the R&D costs and the procurement, the prototypes and so forth. The cost per satellite will be of the order of $12 million. Now, this satellite is twice as heavy and has about four times as much power. Cost might be something like twice as much, $20 million per satellite. Now, the launch costs for Atlas for the present Intelsat 4 are of the order of 16 million. And if you have a Titan 3C, it will be of the order of 22 million.
Another member of the audience suggests that putting so many services in a single satellite might have its dangers.
That's a very common problem with this type of approach. One of the disadvantages that I had listed there recognized this fact that you have an expensive satellite and you have an expensive spare philosophy. You might have to have a reduced capability under certain circumstances, or you could include the reliability of the more critical services by allocating them slightly more redundant subsystems, slightly more weight and so forth. As I said, each of the users has to be still polled as to how much money they are willing to spend on it. There might be another approach, which is a secondary set of smaller satellites to tide you over. If the program itself is supposed to have a 10-year lifetime for the big satellite, and one of them fails, you might have something like an Intelsat 3, which has a design life of 5 years, and you could have that as a backup.
And yet another question on the assumptions about the types of services in the future.
The question is, how about laser technology and new techniques? It's quite true that laser technology has potential, but there have been several studies. ATS-F will have some laser experiments, as you know. When we try to scale it and find out, will it be useful to have a laser link between two satellites, that's where it primarily would be helpful, not between a satellite and Earth, where you might have cloud cover and so forth, but between two satellites. The weight requirements and the pointing accuracy requirements are still quite prohibitive. It's true that you might have additional applications, but in this particular bandwidth requirement, you don't gain anything by going to lasers. For a couple of TV channels, you don't really need lasers. For the type of traffic that we expect by 1980, you need of the order of a few hundred megahertz bandwidth, like 500 megahertz or 1,000 megahertz, and lasers would be more useful and more pertinent when you require many times, about 100 times as much bandwidth. It's still much further away.
It was then asked whether the 12 gigahertz figure represented a COMSAT proposal to the space conference.
COMSAT has made a filing with the FCC, and so have other organizations, and we have proposed this. Now, FCC is coordinating the U.S. position, and they have circulated recently what they call the draft for that, along with the 7th notice of inquiry in that docket, which is preparation for the World Radio Administrative Conference. Yes, we have recommended this, and other people have recommended it too, and it might be accepted.